You're tuning in to the Cocktail Twins on Back in America, a podcast of American culture, values, and identity.
In this edition of Poetism, Back in America's correspondent Josh Wagner is joined by his college friend Scott Stevens to talk about his correspondence and distinctions between the Cocteau Twins' ethereal lyrics and Bridget Piggy Kelly's grounded poem Song.
If you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
Welcome to Back in America, the podcast.
There is a vibration, a sonic event, a sound I want to talk about, but its ongoing movement makes its apprehension both illusory and provisional. Illusory because the thing itself is both given and withheld from view. From earshot, provisional because it, the vibration, the sonic event, the sound, is not and cannot ever be stilled absolutely. It keeps going, it keeps moving, it is open-ended. It can be felt and detected, but remains almost obscure, almost unnoticed. And this is for its protection, and this, its gift. So begins one of the early sections of Ashton T. Crawley's Black Pentecostal Breath, The Aesthetics of Possibility, a 2016 book which traces how the howl, the shout, and other non-linguistic modes of communication and possibly do communicate and form otherwise worlds of possibility. Elegies are difficult. How can we put words to describe atrocity, loss, or pay any kind of requisite tribute to that which was, but no longer is? I'm Josh Wagner. Welcome to Poetism, your podcast of misplaced dreams and desires, poetry and music, forgotten happenings and newfound powers in the second, or is it 57th century, of the American landscape. This week, the staff here at Poetism like to think about loss, but also presence. Absence, but also the distance of the world from the mind. This installment, fresh from the Back in America network, traces the origins and mysteries of sonic breath and the difficulty of description, not only of loss, but of and for the present. Where does breath emerge from, and what does it do to us? Do meanings and definitions actually help us understand what a poem, what a piece of art or life is truly about? Joining me to delve into the acoustic threads of art is Scott Stevens, a recent English graduate from Stanford University and soon-to-be Fulbright Scholar. Scott once spent an entire summer working on a farm in Japan, is fluent in French and Japanese, and we first met in our freshman dorm in college. He selected both of our companion pieces for this week, the Scottish band The Cocteau Twins' Amelia off of 1984's Treasure, and American poet Bridget Piggy Kelly's Field Song, 1995 collection Song. Departing from our usual American-only emphasis, this week's episode focuses on the sonic abilities of words and noise to reveal, unconceal, or otherwise elide common sense. Let's jump right in. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Thank you, Josh. Super excited to be here. As you said, I'm going to be talking about the Scottish band Cocteau Twins, as well as the poet Bridget Piggy Kelly, and a few weird poets in between. So Josh, if you want to play the song Amelia by Cocteau Twins.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm curious, like, what about poetry really draws you in? Like, when you're reading a poem or Bridget Piggy Kelly's poetry, what do you listen for?
poetry that draws me tends to have a sense of mystery. It's like, why bother writing a poem if it's like super straightforward? I mean, straightforward poems can be great, but I tend to like mystery in my poems and in my music. And one of the things that I find kind of funny when listening to music with other poets is they tend to look at the lyrics and listen to the lyrics and pick them apart a bit more than I do. I find that I listen to music more for the musicality and how the sound of the vocals fits with the music, which is very different to how I read poetry. Because when I'm reading poetry, I'm reading for the words and it's all in my mind. I tend not to read it out loud because I'm shy and like reading by myself. But I think that'll be like one of the themes that I'm going to be talking about today is this difference between music and poetry, even as they might produce a similar mysterious atmosphere.
Right. And I love this idea of the difficulty of listening to both the lyrics and the music together, and that there's like no one way to listen to music, or it's really unclear how to listen. I feel like I either get distracted by instrumentals or by the lyrics, and it's hard to oscillate between both at the same time. I love the song, the Cocteau Twins, because you really don't have to listen to the lyrics, or when you listen to the lyrics, you don't really know what they're saying. As you're telling me, like, all they choose lots of foreign words that maybe they don't know what they mean. Chosen for their musical quality rather than some kind of overarching meaning, or at least like literal linguistic meaning.
Yeah, like, I don't know, maybe if I had better cognitive powers, like I could like parse both the instruments and the lyrics at the same time, but alas, I am not. So I'm very impressed with people who can listen very carefully to both lyrics and instruments, but the Cocteau Twins, you don't have to worry about that because they are not trying to really create straightforward sense with their lyrics. Well, so I can get into a little bit of what makes this band so unique. So this band was created, I think, in the early 80s. They became very active in the early 80s with band members from Scotland. So we had Elizabeth Fraser, who's the lead vocalist, Robin Guthrie, guitars, bass, drum machine, production, and Simon Raymond, who I think came later and did bass, guitars, and piano. So their style is said to be very much like part of the dream pop genre, also called shoegaze sometimes, slightly interchangeable. And these are kind of also said to be subgenres of alternative rock and psychedelic rock. I love psychedelic rock generally as a genre, but this group kind of took some of the features of psychedelic rock to the next level. You have Elizabeth Fraser's ethereal, obscured vocals. You have many layers of distorted guitars with flanging effect, which is when you have two copies of the same signal, one delayed, and it creates this whooshing effect, kind of like a plane going over by. And yeah, so there's a sense of everything melding together. The music becomes very atmospheric. The vocals become very atmospheric. And you're not necessarily supposed to make sense of the lyrics apart from their sound.
Right. And it feels very much like a soundscape, like you're being thrust into an experience that where you're not quite sure what to make of it. And the experience of listening to the song is almost like exploring a new world.
Totally. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Definitely.
I think one thing you might get into later is about the more experience of listening to music, which overtakes your whole body. We have all this language of both like consumption, but also like the sound waves wash over you and you're like enraptured by it. I don't often tap my foot to music, but I mean, I will think I tap my foot to the Cocteau Twins music, but often even whatever I hear in Starbucks or on Spotify, I'm always moving to it in some way. Whereas with poetry, you know, it's on the page, it's silent unless you're reading it out loud.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting because I think poetry is often read silently today. Obviously, there's so many exceptions with spoken word and people just simply reading to each other in that old tradition of reading out loud. But yeah, I think you're definitely right in the sense that we expect music to take over us in a way that poetry doesn't always. I think poetry can take over our mind in a way that music doesn't always. You know, in ancient times, poetry was often used as a memory tool to memorize different facts about the world. It was a way of thinking through things and thinking very logically through things, which I don't know if people really expect that of poetry nowadays. We have modern printing, which we have like lots of ways to store information. We have now prose narratives to give stories, which poetry used to do quite a bit. Whereas I think now, you know, a lot of poetry does give this soundscape, dreamscape, atmospheres. I certainly look for that in the poetry I seek out, but I think perhaps many other people also do. So there is a way in which poetry has been almost refined to try and do some of the similar kind of overtaking the self that music has done for so long. I don't know if this makes sense and I don't know if it's accurate, but this is my sense of how things have gone about.
Yeah. And so I'm really curious what you want to get out of a poem. Not that there has to be some kind of like utilitarian, I need to have an experience when I read a poem, but you're talking about this, a sense of like leaving yourself. And so is that like a state you often find yourself in when you're reading poetry?
I often find myself definitely entering some kind of different world. And I think that different world is the world of the poet that has written the poem. And I think we all have different worlds inside of our minds with many different, I mean, people often compare poetry to houses with rooms and various things within it. And I think, yeah, I think we have different chambers within us, within our like souls. An entrance into other people's souls is often through reading their poetry. I try to feel, when I feel like I'm really reading poetry, I'm really feeling it, is when I feel like I've entered into somebody else's world. And other people's worlds may seem fairly familiar, may seem fairly colloquial and everyday with its own type of beauty. But I think it's most noticeable for me when there's a sense of alien otherworldliness. Yeah, and something angelic to it, which is what we'll see with Bridget McGee Kelly. Speaking of other worlds, we will dip into Amelia.
Yeah. And so I think one of the first things that strikes me while I'm listening to Amelia is I have no idea what's going on. There clearly are words and they sound vaguely familiar, but when you try to parse them, you have no idea like where to begin.
Yeah. So I've always been drawn to this band's lyrics because the pressure to parse and understand lyrics is off. It's so hard to parse. Nobody's expected to. But one of the things if I am listening to Fraser's vocals is the vowels. I do have some apparent transcriptions. There are people on the internet who have tried to transcribe and put into abstract Latin letters the words to the songs of the Cocteau Twins. And so from this website I found, we have "Who have been wounded? Who should wound her? Hard on the grasp. Who but who put on the heart?" If these are the words, you get a sense of a kind of an emotional meaning behind it. But if you had not seen this transcription and you were just listening to the song, you'd have "Who've been wounded? Who should wound her? Hard on the grasp. Who but who put on the heart?" And so you have these heavy vowels, especially the oohs, that she really leans to. And then when she sings, she says "hard on the grasp." She really pulls out that "on." And then she quickly says "the grasp." And it's so there's this also this off rhythm that is, to me, is very satisfying. There's almost a sense in which by letting go of what the song is saying and trying to communicate to you through mere semantics, you get to pay attention to the sounds of consonants, of vowels, how those all fit together. This actually, if you believe that this transcription is kind of accurate towards what she is actually saying, you know, you could say, oh, there's a sense to this. But Elizabeth Fraser herself has said that she does not pay as much attention to the meaning of these words. Fraser has this great story of how when she was beginning to sing, she felt very shy with singing, and she felt very shy singing straightforward English sentences, which is something I can very much empathize with. I'm a bad singer, so I get that shyness. And so she just chose words chosen for their sound. It takes off the pressure in a way, and she can just focus on the quality of her voice. And so she would look in foreign books, foreign dictionaries, and she'd make lists of foreign words, which I also love as somebody who just appreciates words in other languages for, even before I know what they mean, you know, there can be something very satisfying about their sound. For example, in Japanese, there's this word dekoboko, and dekoboko means bumpy. It's one of my favorite words in Japanese because also the characters to write dekoboko looks like bumpy, like a bumpy terrain. But even just hearing it, you have the sense that there's something not quite straight or smooth about it. The plosives and the harsh k sounds, it all fits with this sense of being bumpy. You hear words, you wonder, what do they mean? Even with English, sometimes these very Latinate long words can sound imposing or harsh or bureaucratic or elegant. And oftentimes, the meanings do have to do with bureaucracy or elegance. I think T.S. Eliot talks about this in his essay about reading Dante. He says, I think, like, something along the lines of poetry can communicate before it is understood. So there's a sense that you can get a poetic emotion of words before you really understand the meaning, whether that's a foreign language or words in your own native language. There's definitely a way that they can connect in ways that we don't think about in our everyday lives.
Yeah, like, this is a sense in which all language was made up one day. All language is constructed. And that there's something, not straight deconstructive, but there's something about returning to, like, the actual action of forming words that you do every day, but you don't always think about as being part of the meaning. And I keep on thinking about all those, like, O sounds that are in the song, and then thinking about, like, the way you which everyone opens their mouth, like before they begin to speak. And that there's something of, like, the unexpressible that comes through these, like, songs, which are these words just opening Fraser's mouth.
Yeah, I almost think, like, we all make weird sounds when we're, like, in intense emotion, like screaming or crying, whatnot. And I almost wonder, like, oh, is Elizabeth Fraser just taking that to the next step, trying to take more complex, more refined emotions and setting her lips and her voice, her larynx into, I don't know, like, unconscious contortions that is very similar to what we do when we scream or cry.
Okay. It's really cool. It's this idea of, like, a feeling a word, which is this impossible action. You know, words are, like, virtual. They have no, like, actual existence, but there's something of the physical touch that you have. You have that physical reaction to the song, listening it, both from the sound waves that are hitting you from your speakers, but also in, like, the poetic emotion. So the emotional resonance of what those symbols mean in this very, like, indexical way.
There's definitely a mystical power to it. There's a sense in which you get to play with something that seems so normal, and it all of a sudden becomes something. I say mystical. There's all kinds of adjectives you could use. We get into, like, I'm not a super religious person, but we do get into the realm of religion that I particularly enjoy, which is mysticism and the connection with a feeling of the other world, of other worlds.
Right. It's like the sublime overflow of emotion you might feel. And I know you've brought in some sampling of some medieval poets who also feel this overwhelming sense.
Yes. So on the topic of medieval poets and this long line of religion being connected to how we play with sound, there's the phenomenon of glossolalia. I am speaking from the Western tradition. I should have checked into Japanese glossolalia, but it is a big thing in Christian history, Western religious history, this idea of speaking in tongues. So people have described the Cocteau Twins, Elizabeth Fraser's vocals, as being glossolalic. It's basically speaking in a made-up language, speaking in a language that perhaps sounds like it's real, but it is a spontaneous, idiosyncratic way of speaking that is marked by its emotional force. So glossolalia was one of the nine gifts of extraordinary power given by the Holy Spirit. The apostles, Jesus' apostles, were said to go out and speak in tongues to people, speak in all the tongues that were created when the Tower of Babel fell. And there's this weird sense in which the glossolalia is often this seemingly nonsense, seeming language of the heavens that no human can really understand. And yet it's also talked about this kind of speaking in tongues given by the Holy Spirit, I think during Pentecost, can also be used to truly communicate, you know, the word of God to people. So we have Hildegard of Bingen is, I think she was recorded as performing this, and the early Moravian Christians. People tend to be on the edge and very extreme. And we actually also, it still continues today with the Pentecostal tradition of Christianity. So I believe I am culturally not very familiar with the American South, but I think our media definitely tells us that there are many churches in the American South that participate in glossolalic practices, their members speaking in tongues. And not just in America, the Aladura churches in Nigeria, praying churches, they're also, I think, in the Pentecostal kind of realm of Christianity, and they also seem to practice this. So it's a rich practice across many different cultures and areas.
Hearing you talk has reminded me of this very 18th century question about like the language of God before the fall from Eden. How did Adam and Eve communicate with one another in the garden, and trying to get back to a universal language before Babel, before communicating, before you understand what you're saying or what the words mean. One form is scat singing, or the ways in which lots of jazz pianists will try to moan or like sing out loud the same thing that they're playing with their hands. This is dissonance between, as good as Keith Jarrett is at playing piano, he will never be able to sing as well as like a 15-year-old choir girl. And that there's still something of that like creepy Pentecostal moaning that is haunting, but also beautiful at the same time.
Right. People do try and mimic other people's voices in reproductions of other people singing, but I would imagine it's hard to reproduce somebody else's moan. It's so uncontrolled. I like that you brought up scat singing with, like, you know, people like Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Prima. And then also, I had not thought of this, but it's a great point too, like kind of moving with like the how singers move often, or musicians move. You know, there's also an overflow that can happen in the body too, which, you know, I hadn't really thought of that before, but it's true that there's an overflow in non-semantic utterances, but also through the human form.
How do you express, where does all this energy go? Is the question, and that's the answer. It's like,
and it, yeah, I mean, and with some people, it does not go into extra words or extra emotion into English words. It goes into these other things. Scat singing, you know, shooby-doo-bop-ba-doo. It is this, I think, a little bit more of an actually familiar version of glossolalia. For, I think people are familiar with scat singing. It was, like, you know, part of the dominant popular music in the earlier part of the 20th century. So it's kind of funny to think that these, you know, a medieval nun like Hildegard of Bingen, like speaking in tongues, is actually not so different from this very popular form of music, scat singing. And also, yeah, it's actually, it finds little fragments of this overflow into non-semantic utterances, finds itself in even a Lady Gaga performance. She's just doing it, you know, like it finds itself in so many performers. I think it's kind of everywhere. It just depends on some music lets it come out more than others. And I think it's important that the Cocteau Twins actually came from their cultural origins, Scotland, because scat singing is, I mean, I'm sure it has all kinds of roots, but I think of it as pretty American, especially Black American. But Cocteau Twins comes from Scotland, which is very much not like the same as like Ella Fitzgerald. They came from a place where lilting, or mouth music, which is a form of using the voice as an instrument to create music in non-verbal ways. That's a tradition there in the Gaelic speaking parts of the UK. And I just wanted to like kind of bring people's attention to that, because I think it's a potential source for Elizabeth Fraser's vocals.
It's such a wonderful point. And I know before we were starting recording, you were talking about the sense of like transcendence or entering another world. And I think there's like these moments of tension, of fissure, when you don't know what the words quite mean, you're not sure how to express, how to listen, how to move, and it just happens, gets at this idea of like what you can't control, but still somehow exists through its impossibility.
Totally. Yeah. No. And I mean, I think like it's a little bit out of fashion to really believe or press on the point that there is some universal language, that 18th century / Babel idea that we can get to a universal language. And I don't know if I'm really advocating for that, but I do know that there is something special when there is that loss of control and a sliding into non-verbality that still communicates emotion that I think a lot of people can connect to.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit more about sound poetry?
Yeah. So sound poetry is I'm not going to try and capture all of it, but it's a way of writing poetry that focuses, like we've been talking about with the vocals of the Cocteau Twins. It's a way of trying to capture emotion and convey emotion without the meanings behind words. It's often about the sounds of words. Baroness Elsa von Freytag Loringhoven was loosely connected to the Dadaists. I think she may have been called like one of the first American Dadaists or something like that. But she, fascinating life. She definitely experienced trauma in her life. Her husband committed suicide. She very much lived a very tumultuous time in Western history. And so she, along with a lot of these other avant-garde poets, produced poetry that tried to speak to some of the craze of their time through pure sound. So let me get her poem, Astride. I'm going to read a little bit from it, give you a sense of some of the sound poetry that these poets created. So this is called Astride. Astride, saddling up from fur, night-brimmed, clink-stirrup chink, silver bugle, copper-rimmed, keening, heath-bound, roves, moon, pink, straddling, neighing, stallion. Huis huis su, he approach, he 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 ha, oxygen pressure, a flush, brink, through, foggy bog, they slink, sink into throb, baited, hush falls, stifling, shill, cricket shrill. Okay, and it goes on. In case you didn't know, that was a horse ride. Actually, kind of reminiscent of Ariel by Sylvia Plath for me. But a lot of made up words. A lot of, if you were to see it on the page, there's a lot of words pushed and fused together so that you have all the sounds in one word. And there's a lot of gerunds that repeat themselves, almost like the straddling, nailing. There's like a sense of ongoing. You know, the horse is galloping. You get that sense. And then you also get this weird gibberish in the middle, like hu, su, 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 he, prush. It's like, is that the stallion? Is that the rush of air? Is that prush, like a little bit of grass passing the leg? We don't know. but we do get a sense of some kind of chaos happening after this rush. And in this poem, you do have words that reflect what we think is happening. We have roves, like you're roving. We have stallion, we have neighing, straddling. So this poem does have moments of clear meaning, but she's very occupied with sound. And this is definitely something that a sound poet could do.
That was amazing.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. Yeah, so I don't know if I would call Astride one of like a poem that like speaks to me. It's so fun. It's very fun with language. And I'm sure somebody smarter than me could find some very interesting things to say about the poem. But for me, if we're thinking about the correspondence between the atmosphere of one medium, such as say a song and music, say, how does the style of this correspond to the style of something in another medium? So, you know, a poem, you could look at sound poetry and say, you know, that is very much a direct correspondence between the glossolalic, more sound-based ways of using language. You could say, oh, sound poetry is, it's very similar to a transcription of a Cocteau Twins song. It's very much just a on-the-page version of the lyrics of a Cocteau Twins song. You could make that argument, but I think you would miss out on some of the atmosphere that's created by other aspects of the Cocteau Twins songs.
The poem is always more disappointing than the song, and that there's something a little strange about like these transcriptions of the lyrics, because I don't really want to know what she's actually saying. And that there is something a little bit disappointing about, oh, finding out that there are real words out there you can find out or hunt down in some obscure book where you can have the answer. And that there's something of the mystery of the music that entraps you. How it's the feeling that you're perpetually left in enshrouded in mystery, and it's that idea of wanting to find out and wanting to listen harder and better and again that makes that song so re-listenable and so enchanting in a way that a poem is just not. Like, you can reread poems, but the shift in like meaning is coming from you rather than from this like consciousness or this other perspective that's being like brought into your mind.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, like, you're not gonna, there are variant manuscripts of like various poems out there.
You're not gonna tap your foot to a poem in a way that you might to a song.
I think your mind, the intellectual and emotional part of yourself, can tap its little metaphorical foot. But I think there is, I think especially for page poetry, like I definitely ignore spoken word poetry and like the rhythms it can produce in people. But even spoken word, I have not tapped my foot to a spoken word poem. I do think that there's so much to music that is hard to pin down in a page poem. It's Elizabeth Fraser's rendition of those words. They're so her, they're so hard to reproduce. They're so emotional and powerful. That's not going to come across in a page poem. It's not a recording. You also have the instruments of the song itself. Like that's a really often an important part of music, definitely an important part of the Cocteau Twins. So you would think that sound poetry is an obvious correspondence to the style of the Cocteau Twins, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. I mean, there are more modern poets like Yoko Ono, the Tracy Morris, maybe they do it a little bit better, but I still think that there's something left to be desired.
And I guess thinking of poetry, maybe this is a good moment where we might turn over to Bridget Brookine Kelly.
Yeah. So Bridget Brookine Kelly, in my mind, is a great example of how a poet can create a similar atmosphere to that created by a song, kind of tapping into some of the resources that poetry offers to create that same effect. So
do you want to go ahead and read, I think you chose Field Song.
Yes. So yeah, this will be a good little introduction to Bridget Brookine Kelly. This is from her second book, I believe. The collection is entitled Song, and this is Field Song. Field Song. What stands? The walnut. The tower of story, dark with crows. The leafy way station for doomsayers. Say nay, say no. Say the morning comes in with a silver spoon, and the spoon rattles in a cup because the child is gone. But still the child stands the way a statue does in the mind, or in a field, a fawn figure with a filigreed grin, there beside the walnut and the way of passing things, the wide road down the middle of it all. The middle ground gives way and we are on either side, as in a game. You're it, you're not, you're out. Arms up, you stand. With those taken for all their worth. The lace of Anne, the rods of gold, the stocks made from iron. Their color drains away, but still they hold on, a dry feast, the way things fast toward their absent forms. Go in hunger, go in grace.
Wow. Yeah, so like, what about this poem in particular has made you make the leap with the Cocteau Twins?
A couple of things. And this is not the most representative poem of Bridget Brookine Kelly. Everybody should read the first poem from this book, which was also called Song. And it's wonderful because it has a bit of a story to it that I think people could appreciate. But so actually on the topic of story, this, I think similar to Cocteau Twins, Bridget Brookine Kelly is definitely a poet that de-emphasizes narrative. So in Cocteau Twins, you do not really get a sense of a story. Nothing linear, nothing really telling us much of a story. And I think Bridget Brookine Kelly, you can get stories, you can get even a sense of maybe of an arc of emotion, but she tends to focus on images and the atmosphere created. And if there's any story, it's like, it's more of an implied subtext. So I think that, I mean, and the thing is that many poets actually working today do this. So this isn't that special Bridget Buchan Kelly, but I think I would not think of the Cocteau Twins reading her if she had more narrative in her poetry.
And the first on the poem, what stands, is such a simple question, and it gets unfolded in all these different ways over the course of each stanza, and the way in which these images, like of a statue, of the child, of crows, like interweave one another. As you think about standing in all these different ways, it like multiplies across memories, and then like literal statue standing.
Yeah, no, thank you for mentioning how there's these all these various figures in the poem. It tends to have all these figures, and they interact in this web of association, web of hinting at what did they have in relation to each other? What do they have in common, or what is contrast against them? And it's a web of relation that I tend not to find as much in fiction. I mean, or in narrative, obviously. You know, that these kinds of poetic associations totally exist across a narrative, but these figures, they don't create a plot together. They don't cause something and then another like figure slash character then responds in turn. It's not that same kind of movement that a narrative can have.
Right. There's no causality, right? It's not like you need one thing to happen to cause another event. These things are all like exploding into one another. And I love your word earlier, correspondence. Which I think is such, like, it's such the right word to talk about this kind of feeling you're getting, wherein it's not an impression and it's not a conversation. It's just two things being put next to each other, and maybe they relate, obviously, maybe they don't relate, but there's something that is created through that conjunction that is not definable or only in each object themselves.
Totally. Yeah. I think that's a good way to explain what I meant by correspondence. I definitely appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. And one thing also I want to ask you about is like the form of this poem. And it's probably not clear from when you read out loud that these are all three line stanzas or tercets, and that there's this potential enjambment. There's some italicized words. There's these like, there's questions, but also kind of commands. Say the morning comes in with a silver spoon. Does it come in with a silver spoon? Does it not? I like want to know. And there's all these kind of ambiguities and doubts. And so that was not a question. But my like vague concern and thing I'd love to hear you say more about is this the way in which this poem seems for me to speed up a little bit? Or there is some kind of lilting rhythm to it? And how they're like each thought is fragmented in all these different ways, both on the level of what's this poem actually about, on the level of the formally and level of the lines being broken up, both and jammed and with kind of these italicized words. And it also ends in a very simplistic place with, go in hunger, go in grace, which is such a quiet ending to a poem that has been so expansive and expanded across so many different characters and locations and boundaries.
Yeah, I'll talk about the end. But first, I want to talk about what you mentioned, which is the speeding up. I love that because we are talking about the musicality of a poem. Like, you know, poems do speed up. Poems do have a sense of beginning slowly, but then increasing a tempo in a way. The words are arranged and the images are arranged in a way that makes you want to read it faster, or it feels faster. You can do this with shorter syllables rather than longer syllables. I think Alexander Pope talks about that in his funny satirical poem that I'm blanking on the name of. It's him basically talking about like an aesthetic conception of poetry. And you can, there's all different like techniques, like, as I mentioned before, the resources of poetry that you can use to create certain effects in a reader. So here we have, say the morning comes in with a silver spoon and the spoon rattles in a cup because the child is gone, period. But still the child, and you have an enjambment, stands the way a statue does in the mind, colon, or in a field, colon, a fawn enjambment in the next, into the next stanza, fawn figure with a filigreed grin. And we have this really strong F alliteration, which is a little bit breezy, but still a little strong. And then the I sound, figure with a filigreed grin. And are all kind of fast feeling sounds. And then another colon, there beside the walnut and the way, another enjambment of passing things. There's a sense in which all of these little enjambments and into the next stanza or to the next line are really, is there, it's really jamming us along. But each of these short lines, very, they make sense. They stand on their own. It's not like one of those enjambments where it's purposely trying to trip us up. It really just thrusts us into the next line. So this is what I meant by a poet can choose things to make us feel that things are going faster or shorter.
Yeah, and I guess the other stanza that I'm really drawn to is the bottom of that page. You're it. You're not. You're out. Arms up.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Which is descriptive. It's imperative. It's so short and commanding in a way, but it's such as to leave you in total doubt and mystery. It's Gamer Tag, conceivably, but it's so like dissociated from like my childhood experience of playing tag that I don't know what to do with it.
Right. Well, it's a very quickened abstraction of, again, you could say tag, and it's like, you're it, you're not, you're out. It's like, that's quick. Like, that's like a very, very quick game. It's basically a sketch of the game. So that's a great, another example of like, you can just, this, that's the game of tag in a nutshell. And I think it's actually important that it's so quick because it says of passing things, the wide road down the middle of it all, the middle ground gives way and we are on either side. As in a game. It's hard to talk about the meaning of this. Bridget Begin Kelly talks a lot about death. If we are reading death into this, you can read a lot of things into this. Let's say we read death into this. You know, is life a game that we try to tag each other and then we're out and we die? Like there's a sense of like a kind of black humor to this of just life is so short. There's a kind of a game quality to it. But then also, but it's like she doesn't use the word tag. Like it doesn't even have to be tag, actually. You know, like I think we both agree that it could be tag, but there's also a sense of like, what is this game? Like, what are these rules? Like, what is she talking about? And then she says, she's talking about the statue being beside the walnut and the way of passing things. So there's a double meaning there of like a road. A road is a way of passing things. And then she explicitly says the wide road down the middle of it all. But then also like, you know, the way you go about doing something when what is you're doing? Passing things. She's talking about this. And then she uses the game as in a game. So she's using the game to describe how this middle ground, this road divides these two sides. And so this is also classic Bridget Begin Kelly. She's using metaphors to describe things. She's constantly using figurative language to point away from the thing. And then she'll point back at the thing and you're kind of lost where the pointing ends and starts. But it's like, and for here, it's like, okay, well, if we're talking about death, if we're talking about afterlives and we're using game as a metaphor, there's a way in which I start to think of like, what are the rules of our world? What is the rules of our game? And what's the rules of this other side of the road that she's referencing. What there's a sense for me of Bridget Begin Kelly of often talking about something off in the distance, something in another world, and she points to it either metaphorically or, well, I guess the road is a metaphor, but the road is trying to point us towards this other side, something being separated, but we could cross to it.
Yeah, like you travel across the road. The road's not a destination, but like an index or it points at something further along. I kind of want to redirect our attention back to those last two lines, which maybe the last two stanzas. The way things pass towards their absent forms, go in hunger, go in grace, which again is both descriptive and imperative. And also, I love that use the word fast there in connection to both to not eating, to this kind of biological fasting, but also the speed of these lines and of the road and of this idea of traveling and then.
Totally. Yes. The road, the travel. And as we talked about before, the speed of the words themselves. And you do get a sense of the thematic coherence, which is something that you don't always get with sound poetry. You know, like there's much more of how does this word very much relate to other words that have made sense up till now. And you also have a dry feast, the way things fast. So you do have words continuing to echo with each other. And that echoing is very strong in Cocteau Twins actually too. But yeah, and the way things fast towards their absent forms. Another thing is the religious connotation of fasting, the way things fast towards their absent forms, a sense of fasting away to and wasting away towards a higher purity, like a purity away from this earthly body. I think Rumi, the poet, talks about the glory of the fast, the drunkenness of the fast, the sense of like, yeah, you're like elevating yourself to another world through cutting away at that corporeal form. And she ends with, in my mind, kind of Catholic style language, go in hunger, go in grace. And yeah, go in hunger, go in hunger is obviously not something you're going to really hear at church, but go in grace is. And when we combine that with the word fast, you are then alerted to the potential religious dimensions of this poem.
Right. Yeah. And this is also an idea of like a vessel, of like what you carry inside of you as being emptiness or a space for God. I keep on thinking about Simone Weil and how when she was fasting and going these very extreme like deprivation rituals, she would return to this George Herbert poem, Love 3, and just repeat it as a mantra over and over and over again, which somehow the repetitions would unlock some hidden meaning and allow her to like get through these like mind-bogglingly physical exertions and experiences. And that there is something of the repetition here that is really interesting. There's a way in which this poem develops much more for me than Amelia does musically. You're thrust into an environment and you spend the entire song exploring it and figuring out what's there. But it does feel like one note, that if you heard a second of that song or an hour of that song, you'd be having something of a similar experience. But there is something of like a development or a change within Field Song that's just totally alien or just not a part of the music.
Yes. Yeah. No. I mean, I think, as you said, like this poem definitely offers us some things that Amelia can't, even though they do have this, I would say, religious. I kind of always think of the word purple when I think of, or like the color purple when I think of Bridget McKean Kelly.
Oh, yeah. We were talking beforehand. Scott was saying that the word purple comes to mind both for the Bridget McKean Kelly poem and also the Cocteau Twins, which I thought I would never have said that, but that it's so right. And that this is like this haze that comes over you that I get, like it's like the purple from like a sunset that suffuses.
Yes, the dusky, beautiful, kind of bright, kind of fading, definitely a little sinister purple heliotrope. So that's the poet side of me being like, these are both purple people. And yeah, like repetition. Like I really like that you brought up that mantra, like repetition that Simone Weil did. You do get a lot of repetition in Bridget McKean Kelly. You certainly get repetition of phrases in Cocteau Twins. But then also in, I think, in the same way that you get repetition of vowels in Cocteau Twins and repetition of vowels in Bridget McKean Kelly, you can get repetition of images and thematic figures in, say, McKean Kelly's universe. So she has a lot of birds, goats, deer, doe, little destructive boys, and then birth and death. These are big things in her world. But I think part of like the fact that Bridget McKean Kelly clearly shows us these images, it's not gibberish. She says, I'm giving you an image of a bird. And then the reader says, yes, I understand, you're giving me an image of a bird, rather than, what did Fraser say in that song? I don't know. Like, did you say bird? I don't know. One of the positives that you get from being able to clearly say, hey, Bridget McKean Kelly has just written about a bird, is you get to make sense of it and combine all of these images together. So you have these juxtapositions of innocence, and yet sometimes the innocent animals can also be a little bit threatening. Nature is both this beautiful thing and yet can also kill. Young boys are like not the same as like burly men, but they are often the ones destroying nature. There's something very exultative, very much shining a light on the glory of nature in McKean Kelly's poems. But there's such a dark side to it. It's an ecstasy with the threat of its breakdown just around the corner.
Yeah, of death, as you're saying earlier. That is like the threat that makes the beauty possible. And maybe that's actually a good point of connection between the song and the poem we've been trying to think together today. It's just the danger implicit within the psychedelic beauty, like the nebula that also implodes suddenly and you don't know where it's gone.
Yeah, I like how you use the word psychedelic, because I think it's not only in Cocteau Twins, but in many bands like them. There's a beauty in the notes, but there's added beauty to the feeling that it's not quite settled. It could go into a strange and frightening drum, like a guitar sequence in the next lines. In Amelia, in the song, there's a sense in which the song keeps on plunging downward, even as it also feels like it's going upward. There's a sense of like, Fraser will sing vocals high operatically, almost like a bird going upward, but the guitar will sometimes feel like it's plunging down, or there's almost like a little bit darker notes edging it. So I chose Amelia because, to me, it's one of the songs that came to mind that really does hit this comparison with the McKean Kelly home of a beautiful garden statue, but there's a dark shadow behind it. There's a snake wrapped around its coil. The images of Bridget McKean Kelly try to convey this sense. And I think a lot of the notes, instruments, along with the lyrics in Cocteau Twins conveys that same sense of ecstasy and danger.
Actually, maybe that's a good point to end on. This embroiled and contradictory nature of the thing that allows you to have this experience is a thing that also destroys that experience. Is there anything else you want to talk about in terms of these two works?
I think we've compared them as much as they themselves would allow us. And I would say, you know, I find a correspondence between these two, but it is my personal impression. I think impression is a good way to describe that, how I have thought of this. But there is, I think, like, it's cool to think of music versus poetry. And I think you're going to talk about dancing, maybe all kinds of genres and how they might correspond to each other, and how we can think of the less obvious correspondences. Because sometimes the most direct ones don't actually work.
Amazing. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about these two works, Scott.
Yeah, thank you for having me.